You're listening to a podcast from 702 and Cape Talk.
7 minutes after 10, as promised, we're going to be focusing on political violence in KZN in particular. And there's so much here that's murky, including the facts, the body count, let alone who's responsible, what is the narrative, what are the patterns behind politically motivated killings in our country, and in particular in KZN. We'll do our best to lift this to the surface within the next couple of minutes or so for the entire hour. In fact, if you are a researcher, if you've had experience, if you've got views, chip into the conversation. The lines are open and I love hearing from you. So you can do that by giving me a shout throughout the next hour on the numbers 011-883-0702 and, of course, in Cape Town on 021-446-0567. In the studio with me is Richard Pithouse. He is no stranger to this program. You have enjoyed his insights before. He's an author, an academic researcher, and currently an associate here at the Wits Institute of Social and Economic Research. But I first met Richard at the university, currently known at Rhodes, where he's been teaching for a while as well, before that KZN. And he's been writing about that project longer than the rest of us who have been late to some of the political sociology around the violence and the neo-colony and some of the horrible continuities with the pre-1994 state. Richard, thank you so much as always for making time for us and for coming into the studio.
It's always a great pleasure.
And on the line, we've got in the first instance, and I want to chat to her first before I speak to Richard, is independent researcher and head of Project KZN, Violence and Peace Monitor, Mary DeHaas. Mary DeHaas, again, no stranger to public discourse around some of these issues, particularly in KZN. Mary, thank you so much for your generosity and agreeing to come on the show. I really do appreciate it. Hi there, Mary. Can you hear me? Okay, we've got a problem there with Mary's line. Shall we try one more time, Maha? Okay, while you try and sort that out, I'm going to start off here with Richard. Richard, I'm always mindful in the media, if I, as a journalist, suddenly discover something, then you blow it out as the truth, the urgent truth, and as a new truth. But I think step one here is to try and get a grip very calmly, as horrid as political assassinations are, on what is truth and what is fiction. And I appreciate some of the methodological limitations with the empirical side of this conversation. But did we ever in this country, and maybe let's start nationally, have a clean break from a past where political violence was rife for many, many decades, centuries in many ways, but in particular leading up to 1994, horrible political violence, particularly in KZN. And I think some of us have this idea, unexamined, walking around, that we then had peace, and suddenly in the last year or three, we now have killings again.
Well, I think that there are parts of the country where there was a marked change after the negotiated settlement in terms of violence, in terms of actual physical violence. But that's not true in KwaZulu-Natal. There was never a point at which the normalization of violence, the sort of routine use of murder as a form of political contestation and control was ever really stopped. So it's not like it disappeared and then it came back. I think what happened is that after 1994 and the new constitution 2 years later, there was an assumption in many people's minds that when violence was present, it was the past sort of still hanging on in the future and it would go away in time. I think people didn't take it seriously for that reason. They didn't understand that it became a constitutive feature of the new order. Of course, now, more than 20 years later, when it is so obviously so entrenched, I think that naivety has to a significant extent been undone.
Okay, let's see whether we can make contact with Mary now. One last try. Mary, good morning to you. Thank you so much for coming on the show. Can you hear me?
Good morning, CBS and listeners.
Hi, Mary. Thank you so much. It's really a wonderful pleasure having you on the show. Mary, I wanted to start. I mean, Richard has already made the observation that in KZN, for example, we did not have discontinuity with the past in 1994. Perhaps in some parts the numbers tapered off or the media attention did, but sadly political violence has been mainstay. But I want to talk facts and figures. Can you firstly tell me how good are we, or how good are you guys as the researchers at documenting the body count? Do we even have an accurate idea of political violence in the province in terms of the numbers and patterns?
Look, it's become increasingly difficult. I think it's because the nature of the violence has changed, and it's become more difficult to establish the, exactly what's behind it. In the 90s, and it carried on after the elections, I mean, I did document, and this was with names, 4,000 deaths in the period 94 to 98. And that was mainly, you see, because it was quite obvious then that the actors were the ANC and the IFP, and stirred up actually by reactionary policing forces. Then it tapered off in the 2000s, but it erupted periodically around elections. Now, there again, it was, one could sometimes get a sense of who the actors in this were. And also, there were quite a few councillors killed because, and then it became murky because when councillors were killed, it could have been linked to competition over getting the position of candidacy, etc. So it has its peaks. Then there was quite a peak of it after the NFP broke away from the IFP a few years back, and there were quite a few killings then, but there were also, there was a period of quite a lot of deaths of both ANC, IFP and NFP because of coalitions. Now, it's in these years, these last years, that it's become really difficult because often, even now, I mean, as I said to the commission that's sitting now, you know, you can document what you know about people killed in a political context, but you may find out the motive is because they've got taxi interests, business interests, there's personal relationships in the family that have stirred it. So all one can do really is note what one can find out about people like councillors or party officials who are killed and say, look, this is a minimal figure. I'll give you a very clear example of what is basically political violence, but you can't necessarily say that everybody has died, was killed for a political motive, and that's in Gleeblands Hostel in Durban, which started its very, very clearly intra-ANC a battle against the sitting councillor. And in the last, since about April 2014, between 80 and 90 people have died. Now, most of those deaths are linked to political actors, but you know, it's difficult to go through and say, well, this was political, that wasn't political.
What about the rest of the country, Mary? In preparation for this discussion, I mean, I read one report from a researcher in this field, David Bruce, obviously very well known to both you and to Richard, and David was suggesting that when it comes to political killings in post-apartheid South Africa, that some 90% of the share happens specifically in KwaZulu-Natal. Would you agree with that figure? That's a massive concentration in one province.
Look, it's probably correct. I have not documented in detail the killings elsewhere in the country for reasons that, I mean, this is just a sideline for me, this political violence. I've got other more interesting research concerns. But, I mean, I've been doing it for so long, and the reason I keep doing it is that really there's no one else doing it because there's no funding for it. But I also have networks here. I know a lot about policing in the province. So I pick things up. So my focus is in KZN. And I would imagine, I mean, I do see political killings elsewhere. When I say political, it's clearly linked to tensions over, for example, corruption features all over the country. I think the people get taken out because they don't tolerate corruption that they see. But yes, and I mean, look, there are specific reasons why the violence has been high in KZN. Since I think it's been building up, I mean, even in the 2011 local government elections, there were lots of tensions because of the divisions within the ANC, and those have become sharper So by the time we got to the preparation for the local government elections last year, the killings were just happening quite frequently, and it was linked to the tensions and the factions within the ANC itself. And don't forget, this province is the biggest support base for the ANC, ironically, given its history of an Inkatha base, but it's become the biggest support base for the ANC, and the Durban Metro is the biggest region in terms of sending delegates to conferences in the country. So that seems to be the underlying motive now.
One last empirical question I wanted to ask you is, in general, have you been able to ascertain what actually is being done from a law enforcement point of view to get on top of the situation in KZN, and what the attitudes of the police are, or whether they themselves are part of the web of what you've just referred to as factional battles inside the ANC, Mary?
Oh, look, this boils down to the ineffectiveness, and I'm putting it very kindly, of the law enforcement agencies. I mean, you know, if we look at Liebland's Hospital, where we have a very detailed information, thanks especially to Vanessa Berger, who's documented it in detail, that, you know, there's been 80, 90 dockets there. This is just killings. We're not even talking about all the attempted killings, because don't forget, when I give figures for minimal numbers of deaths, that doesn't include all the attempted murders. But, I mean, there hasn't been a single conviction in 3.5 years almost. So, I mean, that speaks for itself. And, I mean, with the killings that, I mean, I documented, I think, 22 in between the beginning of last year and the elections, there's been another at least 16 since then. I mean, these are minimal figures. But, I mean, there've been a few arrests. I think there's one case in court. But, I mean, in Cleveland, the evidence is overwhelming. Now, I mean, it's a general problem. We've probably got the worst policing in South Africa in this province. There's historical reasons for that too. But, I mean, crime intelligence is kind of a contradiction in terms. I mean, it's non-existent because, you know, we're talking now crimes of omission by the police, that they don't do their jobs properly. Then detective services is shocking, absolutely shocking, in terms of investigations. Mm. But then you get to the question of collusion, either by acts of omission, well, usually acts of omission. I mean, I'm told that one guy who's operating with impunity in the southern part of the province has protection from the police. And I've seen it. I've saw it in Maritzburg a few years back, where police at a big station at Maritzburg were actually persecuting members of a political faction in the ANC because they were on the side of the other faction. So it varies from area to area, but it boils down to shocking policing. I mean, the only way to deal with this, and I keep saying this, and I've said it for Cleveland, I say it now, the best we could do is probably have a national team. For what that's worth, it couldn't be worse than the local detectives. We actually want a national team to come down and do investigations.
Mary, thank you so much for your insight, the work that you do with limited resources. I really appreciate that. I think you've sketched us the empirical context of this discussion. Mary is an independent researcher and head of Project KZN Violence and Peace. And I want to thank her for coming on the show. We're going to take a break here. Richard Pithouse is still with me in the studio. And we're going to try and unravel what is going on here from the point of view of political narrative. Why has these killings never been dealt with? Is it likely to get worse in the battle for resources and positions between ANC factions, but also given the state of the economy, and why the criminal justice system seems to be so tardy and also needs to be held accountable for its inaction, as Mary referred to, in dealing with the situation? So complex dynamics there. If you've got a question for Richard, if you have a viewpoint, if you've worked on the area, give us a call on 011-883-0702 in Johannesburg, and in Cape Town on 021-446-0567. Political violence in KZN, it is of national importance, even though we're focusing on KZN. And I hope that you are enjoying may be the wrong word, it's quite a macabre conversation, but seeing the significance of dealing with this political security problem.
Eusebius is on Twitter, @Eusebius.
24 minutes after 10, we're focusing on political violence in KZN. And Richard Pithaus is here with me in studio. Richard, I don't even know where to start with this one because there's so many complex, interesting, fascinating, scary sub-themes. But I was thinking in the passages now, it's not that Richard leaves me breathless. I was just running to the bathroom. Maybe one question I wanted to start off with is, how much of this conversation is a KZN-specific conversation, and how much of this conversation really is about the country?
Well, a lot of it is particularly about KwaZulu-Natal because politics there has been different, and it has had very different material outcomes. I mean, there's no doubt, and David Bruce has shown this and Mary repeated it, that the overwhelming majority of political assassinations do happen there and have happened there. But of course, it's not unique to KwaZulu-Natal. It has happened elsewhere in Mpumalanga and other places. I think it's very important to understand, and Mary did make this point as well, that, you know, we're sitting here in Sandton. This is the economic capital of South Africa. But there's particular respects in which the political capital of South Africa is neither Pretoria nor Cape Town. It's Durban. And that is seldom taken seriously. And what happens in Durban in many ways does set the tone for the ANC and for the country in very important respects. So we can't assume that if violence, you know, murderous violence, lethal violence becomes normalized in KwaZulu-Natal, it's not going to start to appear elsewhere. I think it's inevitable. So it shouldn't be contained as a local problem. It should be understood as a national crisis and one that, if it's not addressed, will, you know, eventually we will have assassinations in Sandton too, if we don't address it.
If we stick with the particularity before then, bringing it back to Sandton and Pretoria and the rest of the country, I think the assumption that those of us who don't pay attention to the political capital, that is Durban in reality, have made, and those of us who don't pay attention to the particularities of the KZN story, Richard, the assumption we made was, as IFP's political power is reduced, and it is really just a glorified cultural organization with an old guy, the Helm, who should have retired 50 years ago, and the ANC's majority through President Jacob Zuma, in part because of the ethnicity question in the IFP being broken in the person of JZM being himself of Zulu ethnicity, that somehow will lead to fewer tensions. And the one thing Mary said that I picked up on that was fascinating, which maybe brings us back to the national picture, mm-hmm. is that even if you have one party doing very well and the DA slowly making inroads and the IFP-ANC battles of 1994-1999 are no longer a real political thing, that nevertheless, it doesn't mean that you don't have internecine political battles inside the ANC itself.
Yeah. I mean, I think that schema she sketched out of the majority of the violence being between ANC and Inkatha as it was then, and then the split with the NFP from the IFP, and then later the sort of factional conflict within the ANC, does broadly explain a lot of the kind of trajectory of the majority of the killings. And I think you are right also, Eusebius, to say that it was a kind of common sense at a certain point that Inkatha is responsible for the violence. Once Inkatha is neutralized, the problem will go away. That's turned out not to be true, and it's turned out not to be true for various reasons. I mean, one of them, of course, is that there was a real civil war in what was Natal and KwaZulu in the late 1980s. And in both sides of that conflict, and this happens in all militarized situations, whenever politics becomes militarized, the people who rise to the fore are the people who are good at violence, who have a capacity for violence. That's very different to a kind of democratic politics in a trade union or a community organization. And of course, the political discourse, the political imagination begins to center violence. And that's not unique to KwaZulu-Natal. I mean, we see this with the EFF, we see it with some student politics. There really is often a desire to center militaristic imagination. But there's something else that's happened that is not often taken seriously, which is that Inkatha didn't just disappear. It was very often absorbed into the ANC. So, you know, people think about our political crisis now as, you know, something that happens from the top down. You know, the fish rots from the head, Jacob Zuma. Jacob Zuma is a problem. The fish does often rot from the head. But we have to take very seriously that there was a movement within the ANC, not broadly like it was reported, but a popular movement in the ANC, strongest, of course, in KwaZulu-Natal, to bring Zuma into that position. And the key person, his key lieutenant on the ground, at the, you know, when the big sort of confrontation happened at the ANC conference in Polokwane, was a guy called John Mhunu. John Mhunu had been an IFP, or Nkata as it was, an Nkata warlord in a place called Mpentle. He joined the ANC at the end of apartheid. He didn't change his politics. And he was reported, I mean, almost no one took this seriously, I think except for Naren Tulsi, who wrote about him in the Mail and Guardian. And if I remember Naren's phrase accurately, he referred to him as a Chicago-style mobster. But he was a man who grew up in politics in a very violent context. And, you know, I think there's very suggestive evidence of him being a key figure in various kinds of political violence that happened after apartheid, not just intra-ANC stuff, but also attacks on independent community activists and so on. Much of it with the same kind of model that Nkata had used. So, you know, an attack would take an ethnic form, would take the form of driving people out of their homes, burning their homes down or breaking their homes down. You know, there would be an attempt afterwards to make everything appear murky and to say, well, this was really just criminality, when it wasn't just criminality, it was a political attack. So I think we need to take seriously how the ANC in KwaZulu-Natal has changed and how, to a significant extent, it has absorbed Nkata.
Brilliant. You are listening there to the enthralling voice and learnings of Richard Pataus. More on the other side of this. And I want to pick up on that particular point, because we sometimes don't talk enough about who it is that you inherit when you expand your political base. We've seen this throughout the country in many other ways, and I want to come back to that before we talk about law enforcement. Richard, I want to pick up on the last thing you say, because for me it goes to political culture as a species of organizational culture. Mm-hmm. And simply put, I get Richard, he used to be my enemy, I bring him to my organization, and you think Bob's your uncle, everyone lives happily ever after. But of course, if I don't acculturate you into my values, or we don't map up out a new set of values for our new relationship that we have, at some point we're just going to reproduce our old ways of being. We see this with the SAPs, for example. Karima Brown, a couple of months ago, made the point on my show that, quite apart from the leadership crisis at the top of our criminal justice system, if you are particularly in parts of the country that had Bantustans before, and you had some Kits constable that used to be very thuggish in his methodology, the fact that you now call this guy by new title, tell him that you're no longer in the South African police force, you're now part of police service, doesn't mean that he is now a new species, a new person who's constitutionally minded. He does business as usual. It's not business unusual because he's got a new title. I want you to tease out for me two things. On the law enforcement side, precisely in the first instance, that challenge in KZN. And then secondly, from a political point of view, even if the IFP didn't exist tomorrow, if you bring into your fold people who've always been at each other's heads, quite literally in some instances, it doesn't mean that you have a new political culture just because you have a new reconfiguration of the political landscape.
Absolutely. I mean, I think this is a critical point. You know, in politics, it's often assumed that if you can absorb, you know, your rivals or the people you're opposed to, you can weaken them and you can become stronger. And there are cases where that can happen. But very often, what you absorb fundamentally changes who you are and what you do and how you do it. And there's a difference between winning something in the terms where you become hegemonic at the level of ideas, where people accept a new set of ideas, and a kind of enmeshment of different political forces, which often in history has resulted in the people who thought they're winning becoming a version of what they initially set out to oppose.
Yes.
Now, I think this is very true with policing and with other kinds of administration in KwaZulu-Natal, and it's true generally in all the provinces where there was a Bantustan, although it plays out differently. I mean, I think about policing in KwaZulu-Natal, And there was a notorious police officer called Glenn Niger, who had a lot of power in post-apartheid Durban. His father was a police officer. His father tortured the black consciousness activists in the 70s, people like Streeny Moodley and others. This is what Glenn Niger grew up in. He was not a democratic actor after apartheid, but he got promoted after apartheid. You know, things worked out well for him. He's not the only case, but I think we have to be careful of two things with regard to that argument. One is that part of the ideology that legitimates political violence in KwaZulu-Natal comes from the other side. It comes from the militarization of the struggle against apartheid, and it comes from the language of the Cold War. So there's a language there where there's an absolute distinction between friend and enemy. So if someone who's impoverished and is living in a shack finds that the state sends out men with guns to evict them from that shack, and they refuse that eviction, instead of saying, well, here's a social question, here's a matter of justice, let's approach it like that, let's enter a negotiation, there are a lot of people who come out of that militarized way of thinking about politics who will say, this person who's opposing us has to be really, like in a sort of not in the obvious way, but if you dig down deep enough, you'll find that this person is really an agent of the enemy. So they're really an agent of imperial power or white power. And of course, that's a total, you know, paranoid projection. But people believe it, and that legitimates violence all the time. The other thing that we need to be careful about with that argument is that when people make that argument, they often assume that this is a generational thing, that we're talking about, you know, people in their late 40s, early 50s. Once they're out of the system, things will be democratic. But what's happened is a political culture has been created, not just in the police, but in the ANC, in the bureaucracy, where young people are socialized into it. And they buy into these ideas. So these things are not just of the past. They've become constitutive features of the present too. So we can't have a kind of naive thing that this is a generational problem that will resolve itself in time.
Absolutely. Let's go to Cape Town. Glenn, thank you for your patience. Welcome to the discussion. Hello, Glenn. Go ahead.
Good morning, gentlemen. Mid-last century, there were ongoing reports in the area known as Tugela Ferry, you know, between Dundee and Ishawi. What is the history of this? And is, I mean, this was between the Zulu-speaking folk living there, and is there any relevant connection to the current political killings? I'll listen on the radio. Thank you.
Thank you, Glenn. I don't have a clue. Richard is the clever one here.
Well, I mean, there are histories of political violence that predate the conflict between Nkata and the UDF and the kind of forces broadly aligned to the Congress movement. And they go back certainly to at least the 1930s and 1950s. I don't think there's not any direct connection between any of those histories that I'm aware of and the present. But, you know, I don't know anything about Tugela Ferry. I've never done any research there. So I'm not the right person to ask.
Mohali in Soweto, just turn on your radio for me in the background. I'll come back to you in 3, 2, 1. Go ahead.
Zivius? Yeah. Hello, Zivius?
We can hear you. What's your question or your comment?
Okay, I have a set scenario that I would like the prof or the analyst to please to confirm or deny. You know, I went to varsity there in the early 90s, and we witnessed this kind of killing. And they come in a form of sort of a pyramid scheme. It's so embedded in certain communities that it now swallows the politics of it. But it started in the taxi industry, like Meriti has just said, but it works in as in a pyramid scheme wherein whoever that is on top will assist those at the bottom to get, you know, up to their levels, but using violence. I just need someone to confirm or deny that could be associated with now politics of it.
I think that's definitely the case. I mean, you know, in Durban, there's no doubt that when politicians, ward councillors especially, it's often local politicians or their ward committees or their BECs want to outsource violence, the people they go to are people who've become professional assassins through the taxi industry. And there's a, definitely an enmeshment often between local politics and that kind of violence. And I think it's also very clear that, you know, there is straightforward political violence where it's about political contestation. You know, when the South African Communist Party has its members murdered in Nchanga, or Abahlali Basim Jondolo has its members murdered in Cato Crest or in Kwandengezi, or when NUMSA has its members murdered up the North Coast, that's just political. But a lot of it is about money, about power, about accumulating money and power and doing that through the state. So it's through things like who gets to build houses, who gets to provide the materials for those houses, who gets to provide the security, who gets to allocate those houses to people, because that's also often completely corrupted. And people are often contesting about that, much like people would contest about taxi routes and so on, in a way that is mediated through party politics, but it's not strictly speaking about politics in the sense of ideas, ideologies. So I think that's definitely one trajectory, one part of the trajectory that's brought us into the present. I think the caller is quite correct to point to that.
16 minutes before 11, let's take a break. And then to the top of the hour, we'll unravel a bit more some of the political violence in KZN. If you've got a question for Richard, you can hear that, you know, he knows quite a bit about that region and connecting the dots. 011-883-0702. That's where I'll take your comment, your question, your experiences. You can also just add to the narrative. Perhaps you've done some work on this particular issue. And in Cape Town on 021-446-0567. I don't know about you, but for me, one of the insights of the hour so far that's quite chilling is the question of culture. Culture, whether we talk about it at the level of an academic institution, a corporate, or whether we're talking about a political organization, it's often a very wishy-washy, ethereal notion. It's very hard to get a grip on culture. And yet we should, because it's very clear, listening first to Mary and then for quite a while now to Richard on the show this hour, that when it comes to political culture may not always be changed, even as the political fortunes dwindle of some parties over others. And if you haven't dealt with what it is that you have inherited, what it is that you have reproduced in your own state, in your own political party that is now a mishmash of different factions or different political groupings, then the continuities will, the past will come back to you, haunt you, as horrible and as unpatriotic as it might be to point out continuities between pre-1994 and post-1994. Quite chilling stuff. What are your reflections? The lines are open.
Eusebius Makaiser on 702 and Cape Talk.
I'm in conversation with Richard Pithouse, and we are trying to make sense of the political violence in KZN, connecting the dots. What is the history that has prefigured it? What's going on nationally? Why does this matter to you? And Richard, I think maybe a good place to go to next is to drill down into, not to ask you to play Dr. Phil, but my own anxiety for keep stressing the links with national. And I tell you why I do that. Because I have this fear that if someone is sitting in Joburg or in Cape Town and they hear KZN, they will suddenly think, oh, well, that doesn't affect my life. So maybe we can talk about society's responses to violence. Violence in general and political violence is today's topic. We could have spoken about crime. We could have spoken about Uber, which we did. There's so much violence in society. Do you think there are important observations to be made about our responses or non-responses or the ways in which we react as the proverbial public to stories about violence and who the victims of violence are or where violence happens geographically?
This is absolutely critical, and I'm really pleased that you asked that question. I mean, the conversations about the police and about local councillors and so on are very important. But we are a society in which certain people's lives count for somewhere between very little and nothing. And it's not just with regard to political killings. I mean, you know, the numbers of people who have been killed exceeds what happens in certain war zones, and yet it's not taken as a crisis. I mean, I saw an article in Business Day today, a small article on page 3, about deaths in police custody. The figures given there is between 240. It's about 240 people between 2016 and 2017. Almost 2,000 people who've been tortured and assaulted by the police. The numbers of people who killed by the police and other actors like security guards during protests are astronomical. I mean, we all know about Marikana, we all know about Andries Tatana, but I mean, I've counted, and with no kind of scientific method, just by what I read in the newspapers, more than 50 people, in fact, close to 60, that have been killed by the police in protests. People killed by the Red Ants or security guards or police officers during evictions and disconnections. You know, in many societies, if someone is killed by the police on the street or in detention, it becomes a national political issue. People debate it, they protest. I mean, I know the names of people who've been killed by the police in Italy or in Greece, or people in America, of course, people who've been killed in police detention in England. I mean, I even know the songs about people. You know, it's there in popular culture. But people can die in South Africa, like the 240 reported dead in police custody in Business Day today, without their names even appearing, with nothing about who they are. And, you know, one of the fundamental features of colonialism is that certain people are placed outside of who counts. They are fungible or disposable. And we've changed a lot of things in our society, certainly in terms of law and so on. But we remain a society in which, in particular, people who are impoverished or working class and black and who are in certain spaces, you know, township, rural area, the shack settlement, just don't count. And they just don't count to society in a very broad sense. It's media, it's academy, it's party politics. You know, it's not unusual to see, say, on Facebook, a young person who's interested in politics being very moved and angered by a police murder in the U.S. And that's fabulous. I mean, we should be concerned about what's happening in the U.S. or Palestine or Turkey. But that same young person often will be show absolutely no interest if the police, say, kill someone during an eviction.
And it goes for all of us, right? Regardless of your station in life, whether you are an average Joe or whether you are a self-styled political analyst who thinks that you're on top of your game.
Yeah,
because I mean, until you and I became friends, I never really paid attention, to be honest, to the incredible post-apartheid history of repression of social movements in Durban. It wasn't even on my radar. So I want to ask you this. And obviously, I mean, dichotomies are for undergraduates, so it's probably a mix. Whether it's driven fundamentally by a lack of empathy, if lives don't look like your own, they become fungible. Or is it also because we truly do not know? I sometimes get increasingly the sense when I speak to South Africans, including corporate citizens, middle-class South Africans, they're often shocked because they regard me as a sort of left egalitarian type, but I end up showing once I'm in conversation with them or I get paid to do so with political risk analysis, being more alarmist in their eyes than they are, and they already consider themselves to be besoired citizens. Do people just not know, or is it culpable lack of empathy that makes you not wanting to ask questions?
Well, it's both things. People don't know, and they don't want to know. It's both. I mean, you know, when I used to have a column in a thing called the South African Civil Society Information Services, you know, you could see how many people had shared your column on social media. If I wrote about white racism or, you know, corruption in the ANC, the thing gets a huge response. But if I wrote about someone who's impoverished and black, being tortured or murdered in Durban or Pietermaritzburg, the thing, it would disappear without a couple of ripples. It may be very important to the people in that community. You might find that if it's published in a newspaper, you might find that article cut out and placed on the wall of a shack or a community hall. But for society as a whole, especially, you know, elite society, middle class society, there just is very little interest in that. And, you know, we could solve these things. It's not that it's impossible to solve it. I mean, bringing in, like Mary suggested, bringing in a special police team that is from outside the area, that's not linked to local dynamics and politics, has often been used internationally to deal with these kind of entrenched things. That doesn't happen because this has not been made a crisis for people with political power.
Sure.
You know? I mean, and you know, if you read, I don't know, if you read the kind of, in the elite public sphere, I mean, I repeatedly see journalists talking about the break-in at the Helen Suzman Center. And we should be talking about that. You know, it's outrageous that the state comes and breaks into an organization and takes its computers. But I don't see the same repeated engagement with the kind of thuggery, including the destruction of their offices and the theft of their computers, but also torture, intimidation, murder, destruction of people's homes, when it's affecting people who are impoverished and black. It just doesn't really feature in that elite space. People don't know, sure, because, you know, I don't know the names of these people killed in police custody because Business Day didn't tell me. But we also are a society that doesn't want to know. And until we collectively can change that, break with that aspect of what colonialism has done to our society, we're not going to be able to deal with this. I mean, there's a difference between saying anti-colonialism is a contestation about who gets to be in the elite part of society and saying that anti-colonialism is about undoing the fact that our society is divided into these two spaces, one in which people's lives count and one in which people's lives don't count. That's not to say that we shouldn't have vigorous contestation over that elite space. If we're going to have an elite space, it must be deracialized.
Okay.
But if the discourse is about that and it leaves out what's happening to ordinary people, we are going to become a society in which, like in many societies around the world, political violence is profoundly entrenched.
Richard, we only have a minute left, and obviously you don't predict the future, but there's something called future studies, so I'm going to ask you to give me intelligent speculative analysis. Will it get worse before it gets better?
I think it almost certainly will get worse, precisely because not enough people in the parts of our society that have power really care about this. Churches, academics, trade unions. There just isn't enough concern about it. I have taken heart this year and last year, though, from the fact that in Durban, when people who are organized in a very serious way at an impressive scale have been able to sustain an opposition to this, they have been able to win convictions. On Friday, in the Durban Magistrates Court, a police officer who essentially assassinated a teenage girl in 2013 in Cato Crest was convicted of murder. The year before, a hitman and two ANC councillors from Kwandongezi were also convicted of murder. That didn't come from NGOs, it didn't come from churches, it came from impoverished African people refusing to accept that their lives would be rendered disposable, staying with the course, making alliances, and just insisting that the system had to be changed. And they have won real significant pushbacks from below. I mean, if that can be sustained, perhaps. But on the whole, I think it's going to get worse.
If you want to know more, I'm sure you've been enthralled. I can see from the Twitter timeline by Richard's insights. Read his book, Writing the Decline. It is exceptionally good. It's a very good archive of what's been happening in KZN in particular over the last 20 years or so. And as Richard always does in his writings in the Mail and Guardian and the Con magazine online, he also draws very important connections across time and space with history, because there is a deep historical genesis to what we experience in the present. So Writing the Decline, very readable. I highly recommend it, and it will give you a deeper sense beyond this podcast, if you're listening to it, or if you've been listening live to the conversation, of what it is that we are dealing with. And we really dare not underestimate the seriousness of the security threat to the very foundations of our democracy. Richard, thank you so much for coming in.
Sure thing. Anytime, Eusebius.